Hello, welcome to the Mental Health Hour with me, John Manning from Arthur Ellis Mental Health Support. Welcome. It's a really good show today. We have got Anita Devi on talking about SEND, Special Educational Needs and Disabilities in Children, and it's all about the return to school. So lots of people have been returning back to school. Parents are probably quite thrilled with that. But we've been speaking before the show that this might be a bit of a spectrum for people. Some people having good experiences, some people not so much. So I wanted to talk about all the different implications of it. And if anyone hasn't been to the show before, this is a safe space where we talk about different elements of mental health or different topics that might impact mental health, and then talk through some practical steps that you can take that you might be able to work towards improving the situation that you find yourselves in or people around you. So if anyone hasn't heard of Arthur Ellis before, we're building one of the most accessible mental health services across the country. And we do that by working with organisations, by working with different groups to provide one-to-one and group support, as well as corporate training, corporate programmes in order to improve the mental health and well-being of staff. So, hello, Anita. How are you?
Hi, John. Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Thank you for having me.
That's all right. No, it's really, really good. We've known each other for quite a while. It's got to be going on for a few years.
Yeah.
Must be.
Yeah, and it's so good to see how Arthur Ellis has grown with their vision and actually their delivery and also the impact. I understand that, you know, some of the stuff that you've delivered over lockdown has had a significant impact, so that's really good.
Yeah, we've been working with certain groups of young people especially who are very vulnerable, and we'll talk about it in a bit, but you know, people have had different experiences in lockdown, haven't they? And certainly young people, and despite everything going on, in some cases we've been able to improve the well-being of young people by 50% in some cases, which is quite a drastic improvement to their quality of life, which is great. The team are wonderful. I can't take credit, unfortunately, but the team are such a wonderful bunch.
Always about the team. Always about the team.
Yeah, they're wonderful. And you've got a team and you do a variety of wonderful work in the area of SEND. So what is SEND, if someone hasn't heard of it before? What's it all about?
The SEND is Special Educational Needs and Disability, and it embraces the ideas of inclusion, but also ensuring that children with learning difficulties or disabilities get the provision they need. So it's not just children, sorry, but also young adults.
Yeah.
And young people, and then leading them into that level of independent life, adulthood, and, you know, just being for themselves, being able to contribute to society, employment, all of those things. So my background is I'm a teacher, and studied psychology as well, and very passionate about the joy of learning. And because I'm passionate about the joy of learning, I started to think about, well, actually, there are children here for whom learning is being stopped or blocked or whatever you like to say, that they're not able to access the learning. And that's how my interest in special educational needs and disability came about. When I was a classroom teacher, I wanted to know, if someone couldn't access the learning, what could I do as a classroom teacher to change that? I moved forward, became a leader, so I became a SENCO, part of the senior leadership team, and went on to become an SEN advisory teacher and SEND school improvement advisor, as well as consultant. We set up Team ADL, as we were talking about teams earlier, ADL meaning justice in Arabic, and we stand up for people who are different because we are different. So the approaches we take, the ways we think this through are just slightly different, because if we want change and we want progress, we've got to do things differently.
So this isn't necessarily just changes to curriculum or anything like that, but it's the approach to learning, and it's the approach of using different tools, mechanisms.
Yeah, so we do look at curriculum, but I think it starts, our main focus is leadership and empowering the leadership to, inclusion doesn't have to be difficult. It can be part of the norm, but actually it requires you to have a different approach, a different lens, and just thinking outside the box a bit. So we work with a lot of SEND leaders. We are focused on their well-being as well, because actually, you know, like in the aeroplane scenario, if the masks come down, we want the leaders to be strong and in a place to support the children and young people. And also, if children and young people see stressed adults in every aspect of their life, their perception of adult life is stress.
Yeah.
And so it's important for us in school to model good well-being. And I really believe that. And you know, as a classroom teacher, I went through some quite significant life events. A member of my family was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And there was a real judgment call that I had to make around, you know, I was going to have good days and bad days, but I didn't want it to affect the children. I didn't want the children to think it was their fault. And so actually I had to be quite real with them. I had to be quite authentic about what I was going through. Obviously, I didn't have to divulge lots of details, but actually just being open to my own well-being and sharing that with them.
And realistic, I suppose, as well, to a degree.
Yeah, and it helps them understand that, you know, there are going to be days I'm not in a good place, but that's okay.
Absolutely, you know, yeah.
It's part of life, the ups and downs, and managing that resilience for different things is part of life.
And obviously now people are returning back into school, so we're going to have a little look at how lockdown's been for a lot of children, a lot of families, and talking about what might be good for schools to take on board, and also for the parents that might be able to take some things on board to look at how lockdown has been for the different people on the not on the spectrum in terms of send, but on the spectrum in terms of having a good to a bad lockdown. So we're going to explore that and figure out some practical steps that people can take. So Anita, we've been referring to this lockdown spectrum. And I think when people hear about a spectrum, they might think of autism, especially when we're talking about SEND and we're talking about different things. But there's a variety of different issues that can contribute to a good lockdown, a bad lockdown. And you've kind of seen children experiencing a variety of things. So what do we mean by lockdown spectrum when we're talking about it?
Well, I think I would just crystallize it a little bit more by calling it the lockdown experience spectrum. So it's about the experience that people have had, because lockdown is now a global term that we've all had some sort of experience of over the last 4 months. And it's important to understand, for us to understand as individuals, but also to understand for those around us and in our network, what that experience has meant for everyone else and what are the implications going forward. So at one end, you can have a really negative experience. And that might be triggered by, you know, the living conditions. Some people have had to live in flats, really cramped conditions with lots of you know, family, not being able to get out at all. I think thankfully in the UK, we've had some great weather. So people have got out for their daily walks. But that living condition of not having space. Whilst we have and we live in a very technological age, there are still many families who do not have access to Wi-Fi or devices. So they may have been potentially more cut off than others, because actually we've become more reliant on the online space to connect with others. So we need to be aware of that. I think then there's also what has become apparent is a lot of people have what they call incidental community connections. So they meet people at the gate or when they go out shopping or, you know, when they're on the street. So they believe that they've got a network of community around them. But the reality is actually they don't. They're quite isolated.
Yeah.
That has brought home to a number of families that actually they only don't have many friends. And that's quite hard to A, take on board, but actually then to go and do something about. Because if the perception that you have, particularly if you're someone who's quite active on social media and you have quite a large following or groups, people often assume that that means you're quite, you know, you've got a lot of friends. But actually having a large following on social media or friends on Facebook or whatever that is, doesn't mean that at all. And that has become a reality during this time.
Yeah.
And then the most obvious is people have experienced bereavement and grief and loss. And loss isn't just about people, although that's really important. We'll come back to that. Loss of dreams or loss of, you know, holidays that they've planned and saved up for. I know families in my own network who've saved up 2 years for the holiday this year and been contributing to that holiday scheme and actually couldn't go. So there's disappointment that comes in as well. Grief affects people really differently, and we cannot underestimate what people have experienced, whether it's in their close network, i.e. their family and their friends, or it's someone down the road. There was a lovely story of a gentleman in North Milton Keynes whose wife died. And obviously he had to bury her during this time. and he's a 75-year-old, and he got in the hearse to go with, you know, to bury his wife, but he couldn't take anyone with him. So families on that street all got together, they printed a heart, and they all stood on the street and actually waved the heart, almost as if it's a beating heart,
yeah,
to wave him off as the car went on. And it was their contribution to the funeral, which was, I thought, was such a lovely idea.
It's amazing, yeah.
But the reality is that if people have lost individuals, they haven't all had the opportunity to be involved in saying goodbye, doing that farewell. I know of another family where they lost their mother, not due to COVID, but other illnesses. And they have a son who has special education needs, and he wasn't invited to the funeral because he wouldn't be able to understand and cope with the situation.
Mm.
So, you know, when we talk about grief and bereavement, saying goodbye, farewell, some of the processes and rituals that we have in traditions that we have in place help that grieving process.
Yeah.
And then for those who have grieved, has there been opportunities to process?
Mm.
You know, I know from my own experience, when I experienced grief of a close family member recently, it affected my working memory. And I had to intentionally take time out to ensure that I gave myself rest and space to deal with those issues. For my friend who experienced grief of one of her children, losing one of her children, a young child, she had to handle it differently. So I think we just got to be aware, A, that there's going to be, although, you know, this is an experience that people have, it will mean different things to different people. And the scale of it will be very different. I came across a case in America where a young man had lost 7 members of his immediate family during lockdown. Wow. I think 4 due to COVID and then 3 due to other reasons. So he was now grieving on multiple levels.
And that time and space sometimes, when certainly what I've found through lockdown, I'm fortunate enough to have not experienced a bereavement, but in Arthrellis there's been 5 amongst the team, so we all kind of feel that to a degree. Mm-hmm. So there's that time and that reflection period, if you want to call it that, in lockdown, and certainly families, they, you know, the normal day-to-day doesn't stop, work or anything else, responsibilities. So a lot of people don't necessarily have that time. They, you know, they just crack on and carry on, but it doesn't deal with it at the time. It can kind of prolong it. And we did a really good bereavement show with Odette Mould from Harry's Rainbow about bereavement being like an egg. And it's got a yolk, which is the bereavement, but then the white around it gradually expands and grows over time. And the yolk seems smaller, so it'll always be with you, but it will continue to reduce, and you'll be able to cope with it a lot better. But there's probably, certainly in reference to Send and young people, we've seen some people thriving throughout lockdown as well, and having a really good experience.
And so you've got that end, and then you've got the other end where actually this has been a phenomenal experience for many, like you say. So it's given them time to connect. They've had attention. They've needed that space. It's a different pace of learning. So if they've been doing learning activities, I recall one mother whose child is reception age, and they were concerned about his speech and language before we went into lockdown from a school perspective. But during lockdown, she was able to spend time with him, read stories, do all of the things that sometimes get missed in the busy days of life.
Yeah.
And actually, his speech actually accelerated phenomenally. And so he doesn't need any more speech and language input because actually he's made that progress. So there are some who've actually developed new hobbies because of this, new experiences, have taken a very different approach. It's enabled them to try things that they wouldn't normally do. Yeah, people have had a really positive experience. For some people, this has been a really good family time, a good time to be in lockdown, and a good time to try new things. So what we have is two extremes, okay? And I would suggest that the majority of people, though, are in the middle, somewhere along. And it's about managing those different experiences of that time. And like anything, it's you'll remember key things, key moments, and then something will trigger and you'll remember another thing. And I remember I had one weekend, which was Easter weekend, that was actually one of the hardest, I think, for me during lockdown. Easter is a great time of celebration for us as a family. You know, it's a festival that we celebrate. So there was some good stuff that was going on. I'd helped a family friend do a surprise for his wife on date night, all of those kind of fun things. But equally on the Friday, I heard of some teaching colleagues who had passed away because of COVID specifically. It was in three schools. And then on the Saturday morning, I also got a call from my friend. His sister-in-law had passed away. And literally 3 months before, we had all been dancing together at his birthday party and had a great time. And she had now passed on, leaving two young children. And I remember sitting there on Sunday night thinking, if I was to reflect on this weekend, there have been some really positive things and things I've enjoyed. But there's been some really tough things that I've had to deal with. And yeah, how do you synthesize? How do you pull that together? You know, and it took me a while. It took me a while. And I would say I'm normally an internal processor. I like to go away and mull over things. But on that occasion, actually sitting down and writing what I felt about both sides of the coin, if you like, helped me a little bit to consolidate that this is a reality, that I'm experiencing both simultaneously.
And there's a really good message in that of reflection. And obviously, if parents have been impacted by any of this, then if they have been having to, like we said earlier, about just cracking on and getting work done and dealing with the family and all of that sort of stuff, taking that time to actually jot down positives and the negatives, because we shouldn't necessarily shy away from the negative things. They're there, you know. Yeah. We should address them, figure out how we can overcome them rather than just ignoring them, which I think quite a lot of people tend to do. We've also seen in our one-to-one service some challenges, some good, it kind of reflects that really. In some cases, with schools being closed, it's been really positive for a lot of children. Not because, you know, holiday, we can have some time off and all of that sort of stuff. But for a lot of children, it meant that there were particular people that may have been bullying them that they don't need to see anymore. Mm-hmm. Or particular situations that are uncomfortable for them that they don't need to face anymore. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, that's really good. But in other cases, it means that they aren't confronting that and dealing with it and learning the positive ways to cope with those situations. And certainly with one thing that we've struggled with has been supporting children with sensory needs, because obviously that's very... very tactile work. It's very creative. You've got to really be there. So have you seen that as well in parents and in what schools have been doing for more sensory needs like autism or?
So it's actually as school started back on the 1st of June, you know, beginning back, sensory things that we use often, like the weighted blanket or anything, you know, that's fabrics that weren't actually allowed in the classroom or in the bubbles.
Yeah.
And so that has been a huge, huge challenge, if I'm honest with you. And I don't think there's an easy solution to a lot of it either, particularly the tactile bit, particularly where, you know, because that is a very sensory aspect, and we were not necessarily encouraging children to bring in things from home either.
Yeah.
So that has meant classrooms have been, and teachers have been challenged around some of those areas. And so it's about thinking around what else could be used. You know, I think sometimes we look at sensory activities as being in the sensory room. You know, I've come from a place where I did, I'm trained in kaleidoscope, which is the use of light, colour and sound to support health and wellbeing and behaviour. And I think there are other things that can be used that would stimulate another sense when we're unable to give them the sensory information that they need.
So there are alternative methods.
I think it's about exploring. You know, we are in a situation where we can't do certain things. So if these are things we can't do, I think we've got to focus on, well, what can we do and what impact will that have? And to look at different things. And maybe, you know, the senses are very interesting because, you know, they say if you've met someone who's, for example, visually impaired, one of their other senses are often much more heightened. Or if someone's kind of has a hearing impairment, their other senses are heightened. And so we have predominantly seven senses that we're using within the education sphere. And actually thinking about that, how do we heighten the other senses when we can't actually support one of them?
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't think it's easy, and I'm not, you know, advocating at all that it's been easy for teachers. But I do think that it's given us an opportunity to think outside of the box, think differently.
Yeah, and it's very similar to the biopsychosocial model, if you've come across that before. And it's the bio is somebody's physical health, social is their environment, and then psycho is the way that they think and their mind. And if one of them is impacted, then it impacts the other. It's obviously, it's often drawn in like a Venn diagram, so they have a domino effect on each other. And if someone's bio or physical health is impacted by, say, a physical disability or an illness, then it's going to have an impact on their social environment. It's going to have an impact on their mind, their mental health. And really emphasizing the other two, if you have got a physical disability or you have a level of SEND, really emphasizing the psychological side and the social side can have a really good balancing effect for what they're not necessarily lacking, but the changes in experience that they have with their disability or with their ailment. So that's...
And for some children, you don't understand the concept of bubbles or that you can't go into certain areas or the whole idea of social distancing or having to repeatedly wash hands and keep the mask on, not play with it, all of those things, for some children, is actually quite hard. Mm. So, you know, it's understandable that, you know, going back, we've had a mixture from parents of some who are really kind of, this is great, we're getting back to some sort of normality, but others actually feeling a little bit anxious, rightly so, because actually how will their child cope? We don't know until we try.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we've got to get them in the classroom. But equally, I know, having spoken to a number of SEND leaders, these are challenging situations and they've had to really think outside the box to kind of support some of these children. And I think it's also important to mention that, you know, during lockdown, it was a very mixed bag when it came to special education needs and disability. Some children were at home and that had put a strain on parents. Some children were in school because their parents were key workers or, you know, frontline workers. And so SENCOs and senior SEND leaders were having to support home environments as well as school environments. And that, again, has been quite challenging. We were very privileged and honoured to, in July, host with Hayes Education the SEND Leaders Appreciation Day. We just wanted to honour SEND leaders who've, you know, gone that extra mile and done something. And we had a number of nominations. It wasn't about seeing who was the best. It was just about if you've seen a SEND leader do something over and beyond, just write in and tell us. And we had some really fantastic nominations, from line managers to parents. We even had a partner write in and say, I want to nominate my spouse because they've been shielding during this time, but they've still made time to sort out all the needs of SEND children and support the staff in school as well as at home. You know, so I think we've got to sometimes home in on what's working well rather than always focusing in on what's not working. Because if you modify and escalate what's working well, it begins to grow.
So with schools returning back and schools getting back into the swing of things, which is kind of happening this week, really, what can you imagine being the positive impacts of that?
So a lot of the children, they talk about, I can see my friends, and that's important socially. You know, coming back to your model, the biosocial, you know, for them to meet with their peers. And I know people have been using Zoom and Teams and all these other kind of platforms, but it's really not the same as just meeting someone face to face. And I think for a lot of children, that is the excitement of the week. I think it is for some getting back into routines. You know, there's a structure to their week. There's a structure to it. Back into uniform or not into uniform, that's been a mixture, if I'm honest with you, because PE days, children are asked to come in their PE kit from the start. So some children are 4 days out of five wearing their PE kit. So that's been a mix. I also think many children didn't have closure at the end of last academic year. So I know some schools organised year six proms, drive-by proms or events, but there hasn't been, you know, if you think about our GCSE, our A-level students, the exam years, there's not been that kind of closure. So they were building up to this end of the year, we're going to be doing this, and it hasn't happened. And I think as well as feeling excited about going back and all of these other things, and you can be positive in uncertain times, or you can be hopeful in uncertain times, I think there's still some perceptions amongst the young people that we still need to think about. So quite a few young people I've spoken to feel a sense of, what's the point anymore?
Yeah. You
know, what can we really do about it? There's a sense of helplessness that's come in, because this is a situation where actually the world shut down. No one or nothing could actually change that. And so it's really shifted their perceptions about their future and, you know, their understanding of power dynamics or their understanding of authority or their understanding of influence and what role they can play in that now and going forward. Mm. And this becomes important because if you think about, say, things like democracy and voting, we have an increasing apathy amongst our young people in this country who don't vote because they don't think it makes a difference. So we need to really think about self-efficacy and their perception of that and how we enable that through the curriculum, through other opportunities, for them to actually believe that they exist, they make a difference, and they can go on to change things.
So there's three parts to that. There's what schools can do, there's what parents can do at home, and then there's individually what the children need and young people need to do. So because, you know, I think there's apathy can develop towards anything, really. And we've covered apathy before, and it's that sense of just not really caring about anything and not having any feelings towards it. So it's quite an interesting phenomenon, and it's very difficult then to develop motivation or empathy towards other people's situations. And so what could, if a parent is listening to this and they can understand that within their children, that they're just, you know, not necessarily bothered about anything, whether that is school or whether it is probably not just one thing, it probably reflects in a variety of areas in their lives. What could be some tools or some steps that they might be able to take to begin addressing that?
I'm glad you mentioned motivation. So I think motivation, we need to understand, is a child or a young person intrinsically motivated or extrinsically motivated? So some children, young people, like, if you do this, you will get this. And if that's what motivates them, that's what you need to use. It is, you know, and there are others who actually, the minute you put a reward to it, don't want to do it. Because for them, it's about the joy of just doing it and enjoying the process. So the first thing I would say is be clear. And when I was a class teacher, one of the things I would do with the children in my class is the beginning of the induction year of the year, I would try and figure out with the children, and it's not always easy, and it doesn't mean that I've always got it right, but I would try and figure out which child was extrinsically motivated and which one was intrinsically.
Yeah.
And sometimes if I was doing rewards, I would say to them, so what would you like as a reward if you get this? You know, and giving them that choice, giving them back that sense of I can determine my fate over this.
Mm.
I think the other thing for me is problem-solving skills. Problem-solving skills are really key in developing and enhancing self-efficacy, which is the other side of the coin of self-apathy, if you think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's this idea and this belief that I can make a difference and tomorrow can be better. And so we can start with small things. And one of the things I used to do with the children is just kind of say to them, so what are the problems that are affecting you right now? And kind of get them to list them and think about them. And then having asked them to pick one that really means a lot to them. So I remember when we did this as part of our humanities project, the children talked to me about the litter. The local litter was the biggest problem for them. And they were concerned about wildlife. They were concerned about their playing fields and just the general area. And so we took that as, okay, this is our problem. What are we going to do about it? And they had to start finding solutions, thinking about who they could start talking to. Mm. They wrote a letter to the MP. He wrote back, which was lovely for them to receive a letter back, because it kind of, that cause and effect of communication. You know, if you think about what we're doing here in our interview, you're saying something, I'm feeding off that. That's dialogue. That's how communities flourish and grow. That's how we approach things in life. You know, no man's an island. We all say this, but actually what we need is that cause and effect of that banter, that kind of connection. And so if we can do this through problem solving, small things and growing it bigger and bigger, they begin to feel a sense of, I'm a change maker. I can make a difference. Mm. I can think through solutions. I can bring ideas to this. And how they express those ideas might be different. You know, not everyone is going to be able to write something down. Maybe they can draw, maybe they can create, maybe they can make something. But actually, I do believe children have solutions. And if we
absolutely
can give opportunities to say, well, what is the problem and what is your solution for this? That is far better than us or anyone else coming in and imposing their ideas.
But it's having the autonomy to create those ideas as well and be able to have a voice around it. So I think the interesting thing with apathy, and I'm glad you said about sort of small things and making them bigger, because there's a apathy is somewhat connected to stress, as far as I understand it, and my understanding is limited, but it's like it's a curve. So it starts out right at the bottom, goes up, and then it comes drastically down. So if you get too stressed, it tips over and then you're down the hill. Mm-hmm. But if you are not stressed enough, then apathy can begin to creep in. You haven't got enough that you're striving for or enough that you are participating in. And I think that is probably because, you know, there hasn't been a lot to do for a lot of young people over the last few months. And they haven't really necessarily been able to get out an awful lot. I know that the data is kind of showing in cases that they kind of have, but there's not been a lot of the normal activities, you know, cinemas or that engagement that they typically have. And that might lead to being not far up on the stress curve enough to be able to be engaged with things. So one of the things around getting out of apathy is small goals with reward, and not necessarily like you said about monetary reward or rewarded by a thing, but just rewarded by praise. Knowing that they've done something good.
And the evidence will show children like very specific praise. You know, if you can hone in on something quite specific. But there are three kind of just, say, some practical tips that you could think about from within the home context. So each day, if a different member of the family chooses what they're going to eat that day, and it's their meal choice.
Yeah.
You know, and then actually it's their meal time. So it might be that they sit at a certain place on the table. So people are always moving around and they can choose what's also talked about and shared at the meal table because it's their meal, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So let's say you've got a typical family of two children and a mother and a father, or, you know, two adults. And, you know, the oldest chooses, I don't know, Italian night for Monday night. And so they can have the choice of what's cooked, how the meal's done, and all of that around that. So they're now, well, I've influenced the family.
Yeah.
But equally then Tuesday, it might be the youngest has a go. And they have to be tolerant to the youngest as well. And it goes around. And so it's a small daily ritual and activity, but actually what it does is it brings a sense of community and influence.
And it's being actioned. That, you know,
it's being actioned. And love has to look like something. I really believe that. You know, we talk about love and peace and these really high and necessary, and I don't think they're emotions, but they are what we need in life. But it needs to look like something. Another activity could be have a song of the day. So a different family member chooses a song for the day. And I think you can still do this in as we start to move out of lockdown or back into routines at school. So in the evening, just taking 5 minutes for someone chooses a song and everyone listens to the song And then the individual who's chosen the song talks about why they chose it, what it means to them, what feelings are invoked by that song, because music is quite powerful in evoking emotions. And what we want to try and do is reconnect individuals to that emotional side of them.
Depends on the music you listen to. There's been some recent releases that I wouldn't really agree with.
But even the crazy ones, if they're playing that, it's still a question of saying, tell us what that means to you. Why is that important to you? It's not about what music is right or wrong. You know, if someone wants to play a music piece that they value, I want to know why. I want to understand what it means to them, what emotions it's evoking in them. You know, and even if it's something that a child comes and says to me, well, this helps me express my anger, that's a really good conversation.
Yeah, I agree. That's, if I'm listening to songs, there's a lot of sad songs out there, but there are also those songs where you can just grit your teeth and you can have that release of whatever it is, like something rocky or whatever. Yeah. But it's it can be really, really good. And then that could also be helpful for parents to gauge where the child is at as well, you know, like what kind of emotions are they experiencing? Because children find it really, really, we've got an incredible mentor. All of our mentors are incredible. We've got one called Hannah, and Hannah does a lot of creative therapies and art therapies and uses that to get children to express their emotions, because a lot of the time they can't vocalize it, especially if they've got send as well. It adds other complexities.
Yeah. I use colour as well to kind of just say, what colour are you feeling today? And it starts a conversation. And some music, it kind of evokes also movement and dance. So I had a family round with their young children. So we're sitting in the garden and they were really not in a good place. And so I put on Jerusalem, which is a very dance kind of music, and they were up and they were moving. And it just shifted the atmosphere. So again, you know, these kind of 5-minute things doing in the evening together, it just bonds families, it bonds relationships, it's a shared experience, and it's intentionally putting into positive experiences. Because actually, if they're traveling in the car the next day and that song comes up on the radio, it brings back, well, that was our experience, and this is what Tommy thinks of that song, or this is what Samantha thinks of that song, or, you know, Abdi likes this song, you know. And then the third thing that I did during lockdown is we had in our kitchen a jar. When lockdown finishes, this is what we want to do. So we started every time we wanted to do something, because we were restrained, we would write it on a slip and put it in the jar. There were silly things, you know, like I wanted to go to Harvester one morning, and I couldn't, you know, couldn't go. So it was listed. I wanted to put Eggs Benedict's breakfast one morning. It's just crazy things, you know. But we were constrained not being able to do it, but it all went in the jar. And as the restrictions began to lift, we started to look at the jar and think about what things do we want to do and what, you know. And actually, we started to do some of them. So it was not a disappointment that I couldn't do it at the time. It was more about a delayed response. And it's okay.
And that there's a lot of learning around patience and you know, all of that sort of stuff as well, because I think we live more in a world where things are so readily available and so easy to access most of the time.
Yeah.
So that's obviously been taken away quite a lot, and we've for some reason, even though we live very comfortable lives in varying degrees, but all in all, very comfortable lives. So we kind of feel hard done by when we don't get things. I think it really puts things in perspective, but having that outlook on patience that way, and that, you know, we can have these things, but it's going to take time. Some of them we, you know, are going to be impossible, but some of them we can work towards, and then you can start setting those goals and bringing people away from apathy, which is really, really good. And would you say that that's also the way that schools should be structuring this? Because we spoke about SendCos before. What can schools begin to do if they're not already, or from a leadership point of view, what would you say to that?
So whilst the SendCos lead in schools, we have to remember that all teachers have a responsibility for all pupils.
And
I think teachers need to home in on those two things about what was the lockdown experience and continuously ask. And, you know, if I was to have a chat with you today, John, and ask you what was your experience, you'll probably reveal some things that you remember. If I was to have it again in a week's time, you'll probably remember some other things. So it's not a one-off conversation. Mm. Now, this was 4 months. So we need to keep continuously happening, because it might be take a number of conversations before actually the child then says, yeah, and during lockdown, my cat died and I was really sad. And actually, they are still suffering from that grief that they haven't been able to express. So we need to continuously be trying to find different ways of encouraging young people to reflect, to articulate on their experience during lockdown. The second thing is we need to give them opportunities to reflect their perceptions of life now. Are they in that place where they're thinking, what's the point?
Yeah.
And if they are, then actually what are the little things we can begin to do in the classroom, within our environment that kind of starts to stimulate that. So one of the things I did in my classroom is my children knew that I would change something every now and then in the classroom. It would be a small thing. Sometimes it would be a poster moved from this wall to that wall. I had a discovery tray. Maybe I put new things in the discovery tray. Maybe I put a new sign up. It was just, so when they came in the morning, I would let them know something has changed in the classroom, and they had to spend the first couple of minutes while I'm doing the register figuring out what has changed.
Okay.
And it kind of developed this sense of discovery. Things are moving, things are shifting, you know? Mm. The discovery tray I had in the classroom was really great. So if children finished their work before everyone else, they could go over and they could explore, you know, there were objects from nature, there were mechanical tiny objects, there were a whole range of just different things, almost like fiddle objects if you want. But just things that they could actually begin to think about, oh, how does that work? Or why is that shaped in that way? Or this is a piece of rock that has come from, you know, the salt lakes in Tunisia. Why is it that way? Why is those salt lakes like that? You know, all those kind of questions, because we want them to start asking questions.
Yeah. Curiosity, which is not something they would have been doing for the last 4 or 5 months, is it? It's
not necessarily. I mean, it depends.
Not in and groups like that.
Yeah. So I think, and where does discovery come from? Where does curiosity come from? Asking questions.
Mm.
You know, people invented things because they asked a question.
Mm.
And so if we want to give them back a sense of ownership, power, and hope for the future, we've got to enable them to ask the right questions.
Mm. And so that's really good. From the school's point of view, looking at spending time, and would that be individual time with teacher and child to understand what their lockdown's been like? Or maybe I'm thinking that they might be able to do an activity around it with the class.
It's a mixture, and I think this is where the teachers have to be really creative. Mm. So I taught early years primary and secondary, and I think you'd probably handle it differently in different classrooms, because primary you're there with your children, in secondary they're meeting a lot of different teachers, and in early years it's slightly different. But I think you can do some whole class activities. You can also do some one-on-one. So I had a system in when I was teaching in a middle school, so that's primary and secondary a little bit, of called bubble time. And so all the children had a number that corresponded to their place in the register, and at the back of the classroom was some pegs. And if they came in the morning and they really needed to talk to me, they would take their number, which only they knew, and they would peg it to this sign that said, I need some bubble time with Miss Debbie.
Yeah.
And once the kids were doing their work, I would call out the different individuals and they would come and spend some time with me, and I would give them the opportunity to share what was on their heart, what was important to them on that day. So it was just a very visual way of them communicating to me, I'm not in a good place, I really need time to speak, to talk to someone. One of the other things I did is, you know, as they came in the morning, into the classroom, I would often have a quote on the board when I was teaching in secondary, something to inspire them, to make them think. Or if, you know, when I was teaching in primary, I would have a little quote cards on their desk. So as they came in, you know, today I'm going to feel blue and lively or something, you know, just something to encourage them. And they would read that and then go put it back in the box and get ready for the first lesson. There are different ways that we can do this. I just think, you know, teachers know their children, they know their school environment, they know what they can do, but it's a time to think not so much about the curriculum, but about relationships, community, and reigniting community spirit.
Yeah, and those extroverted and introverted differences. I suppose if you were to do it initially, as a teacher, as a group activity, that will help you to identify those young people who might need a bit more of a one-to-one sit down around it. It might be help you to understand which ones are the more apathetic children in classes. And therefore, then you can start to implement a little bit more praise towards them, maybe smaller tasks, more bite-sized chunks, because that will then help them get back up on that curve a little bit more.
Absolutely. Yeah. And creative activities. I had a life-size tree in my classroom. I had a crazy class teacher, but there you go. And one of the activities is I got them to write on a leaf what is their hope for the future, a green leaf. And actually, we just stuck 30 to 35 leaves over this tree. And actually it went from being just a dull brown branch thing to actually having life.
Yeah.
And having meaning. So I think, you know, there are some creative activities that we can begin to do that still embrace social distancing. I accept that, you know, not all children can write. So in that activity, they could draw. They don't have to be able to write, you know, this is what I believe for the future. Actually, they could draw. And if it's something as simple as a sunrise, that still expresses a lot.
Yeah.
If you've got children who are still not at even that level of pictures, then looking at photographs, so a collection of photographs that you might show on the whiteboard, you know, images that excite or ignite curiosity or ignite, you know, so a bee on a flower, for example, really close up would be a great one to put on a board and actually ask the children, what do you think the bee is thinking at this point in time? It deflects from them because it's not about always them, but it gives them an opportunity to start thinking about feelings and others and nature and, you know, just to be creative. So I do think there's scope to do lots of things. I think it's just we've got to move away from being so curriculum centric to actually thinking around what's needed at this time for all children. It's not just about SEND, because there'll be lots of other children who are still struggling with this lockdown experience spectrum that we talked about.
Yeah, and it, we're not fully out of it and stuff as well. And I think that it's not, it would be silly to think that we're completely out of it. But if, as parents, or if there are teachers listening, if you have, if you can register what we've been talking about on that lockdown experience spectrum, if there is apathy present, then start thinking about taking those steps, small steps, praising them as they go, start to get them a bit more interested in things. We said about with parents jotting down the things that they might want to do, but they can't at the moment. It was a pot for the future, wasn't it? Like a jar for the future.
Hope pot.
Giving them the responsibility of choosing dinner, giving them the responsibility of choosing music that you might listen to as a family, things you might watch, I suppose, maybe activities that you can do, putting the emphasis on them, and then they can actually see things play out and see things taken into action, which I think quite a lot of the issues with apathy, from someone who's experienced a lot of it in the past, it does come back to quite a lot of societal issues that you can't control, that are out of your control. So what's the point? And if parents are out there and they do register with that and they do recognize that, then try those steps. And then for schools, we said about understanding your classroom's lockdown experience. Where might they be on the spectrum? And then the ones who may have a bit more apathy that you can register, might require a bit more of that one-to-one, a bit more bite-size objectives, and a bit more praise.
Yeah,
that's really, really good. So, Anita, you do incredible work, and you've got the team around you as well who do loads and loads of different areas of SEND leadership. We won't be able to go into all of it, but it's a huge array of skills that you have in your team. So if there are teachers or there are SENDCOs or leaders in schools that might want to speak to you a little bit more about this reintroduction of school life and the leadership of schools, how might they be able to get in touch with you?
So we've been throughout lockdown offering 30 minutes free coaching to school leaders, and we've had a high take up, and we're still continuing for this term. So you can find that on our website, teamadl.uk. So that would be the easiest way if you really want to have a chat. And we've had some great feedback from some of the school leaders of actually how that's helped them just to talk through and think through. Initially, I did get some comments around what would we achieve in 30 minutes realistically. Actually, when they came onto the call, we got loads done. That's still happening if they want to. We've got a number of support packages that we are developing and are delivering at the moment. So just get in touch with us. You know, we want to support schools. Our heart is about enabling leaders to be in a good place that they can model to young people, children and young people, good well-being. So we have on our website as well for Send Leaders a well-being site. Lots of free resources there. Feel free to access any of those.
Great stuff. And that was the link for it?
www.teamadl.uk.
Wonderful stuff. And if anyone wants to reach out to us here at Arthur Ellis for any mental health, emotional support, we offer packages to schools as well to provide children with one-to-one digital interventions. We also work with GP surgeries, we work with organisations. So if you do want to check us out, parents can also self-refer themselves or their children. So our website is www.arthurellismhs.com. Thank you so much, Anita. That's really good. Thank you very much for your time, for your knowledge, and really hope that this has been able to help some people out there.
My pleasure. It's been really good chatting with you, John. Thank you.
Thank you.